Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, June 14th, 2016. The story of the Orlando gay nightclub shooter, it's going through them changes. Mildly prophetic music from way back in the 1970s. That's my old pal Buddy Miles and Them Changes. Makes you want to commit a crime, the song says. Well, we are now learning that Omar Mateen was a regular at the Gay Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. And what is curious is that the corporate media is playing this angle down. The Associated Press, in a 15-paragraph article that was published in my San Francisco Chronicle today, makes no mention of the possibility that Omar Mateen had gay impulses, urges, or had acted on them. But it is information that's widely available. Rachel Maddow cited Gawker's report on her broadcast last night, and I think her colleague Chris Hayes actually broke that angle on the network level. And this adds an entirely new dimension to this grisly murder spree that occurred Sunday morning at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Here is one of the patrons, a 71-year-old man who has been a regular himself at Pulse for many years.
He used to come in the bar about on the weekend, sometimes he would be there. Sometimes he would miss a couple weeks and then be in again. He was regular. We consider that regular. He was trying to pick up people, men. He's a homosexual, and he was trying to pick up men. He would walk up to them, and then he would put his arm around them or something and maybe try to get them to dance a little bit or something, and then go over and buy a drink or something. That's what people do at gay bars, you know, that's what we do.
When you saw his picture, what went through your mind when you saw his picture?
We just went, oh, like, yeah, that makes sense. There, that's Omar.
That's Omar, and you just heard from Jim Van Horn, who is one of the people who has gone public in identifying Omar as a frequenter of this club. So this shifts from the first claims that came from government and the FBI that this is likely related to terrorism. And while Director Comey of the FBI was clear that they had found no indication that he had been directed to conduct this action, they were speculating that he was inspired to do so by his own exposure to online jihadi messages or videos and that sort of thing. And so we have to really take a step back here. What is emerging is the portrait of a troubled young man who had a failed marriage. And in some of the interviews with his ex-wife, she's asked and says, yeah, he used to go to clubs. I didn't know they were gay clubs. And that she wasn't sure if he was gay or had, suppressed gay identification or urges. And so this becomes a troubled individual who used his ethnic background as an Afghan, his religious preference as a Muslim, in ways that play out in a very irrational manner. And as I pointed out in my News and Comment podcast here yesterday, people are struggling to put rational frames, rational explanations around what is clearly an irrational act. And the idea that the law enforcement agencies, even if they examine every email that you and I ever send, every tweet, every text message, we cannot possibly identify and prevent criminal behavior by irrational people. And yet that is kind of the rhetorical and political struggle that is taking place today. And so I'll continue to watch this, and I'm sure you will too. But we must approach this like we do any major event like this that is overcovered by the corporate media, with a great deal of skepticism. And we have to examine the motives. Why would the New York Times, in covering Omar Mateen, basically on the second day of their coverage, bury the issues of his gay orientation very deeply in this, what turned into be a seven-page printout of their article? It is not until page four that they say, based on ex-wife's comments, she said that Mateen might have been gay but chose to hide his true identity out of anger and shame. A senior federal law enforcement official said on Monday the FBI was looking at reports that Mateen had used a gay dating app, and patrons of Pulse were quoted in news reports as saying that he had visited the club several times. Now, as you can tell, I think this is a very significant development in our understanding of this incident. And yet the New York Times played it down, buried it deep in the article. And I don't quite understand why they would do that. Because I think, as I say, this really undermines the claims from law enforcement that this is a terrorist act, that it's motivated by Islamic radicals. And Donald Trump, of course, overreacts and misplaces his reaction by saying, "See, we need to stop Muslims from coming into this country." And, of course, he blows right past the facts that Mateen was born in the same area of New York that Donald Trump was, in Queens. And Trump flatly misstated, he lied, saying that Mateen had been born in Afghanistan. The other angles that we're seeing are that aside from his ethnicity and his Islamic faith, Mateen was a hothead with domestic violence, workplace violence issues, and he certainly, you know, should have drawn continuing attention from law enforcement in this overheated and extra-constitutional environment. Now, as you know, I don't support unconstitutional surveillance and monitoring of innocent individuals. But when there is probable cause, when there is actual suspicion, that's what our laws are supposed to be used for. Now, there's a very interesting angle on the political reaction. Because tweeting full thunder, and in a speech where he wandered off a prepared text on Monday, Donald Trump accused Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama of being failures because they refused to call what he calls Islamic radicalism by that name. And this is a ruse that goes back to the primary when Ted Cruz was challenging Donald Trump, and Cruz tried to make a big issue out of Obama's avoidance of the term Islamic radicals or similar phrases. And the reason is obvious, because you have a handful of people who might fit that label if it's used by an official U.S. government spokesperson. It conveys to the larger Muslim world a message that can be taken in a vein of alienation. Yeah, people don't respond well when you smear their religious group. And what's interesting is that after months of resisting, candidate Hillary Clinton relented yesterday, or capitulated might be the term, to the bullying from Donald Trump. And she said that previously she had avoided it for the reasons that I just gave, but that since Trump has pressed her, that it doesn't really make much difference to her to call it Islamic radicalism or something similar to that. And in a way that opens up some daylight between President Obama and former Secretary Clinton, Barack Obama today addressed the media after a meeting with the National Security Council, and he went after Trump in a way that directly undermines the capitulation that Hillary Clinton engaged in 24 hours prior.
For a while now, the main contribution of some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have made in the fight against ISIL is to criticize this administration and me for not using the phrase radical Islam. That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. What exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to trying to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? The answer is none of the above. Calling a threat by a different name does not make it go away. This is a political distraction. Since before I was president, I've been clear about how extremist groups have perverted Islam to justify terrorism. As president, I have repeatedly called on our Muslim friends and allies at home and around the world to work with us to reject this twisted interpretation of one of the world's great religions. There's not been a moment in my 7.5 years as president where we have not been able to pursue a strategy because we didn't use the label radical Islam.
And the president goes on for a few more minutes to mention that he's killed a lot of people who qualify for the label radical Islamist. And he mentions the bin Laden raid. And without quite talking about the drone and targeted killing programs, he talks about how he took them off the so-called battlefield. And, of course, I have mixed feelings about the way the president has operated without any oversight, without any limitations on his alleged authority to put people on a list and have our drone operators assassinate them. But in this argument over the terminology and the demagoguery that Donald Trump is attempting to use to inflame the American public and distract us from the real issues at hand, which are that a man who had access to buying an AR-15 within the past 2 weeks, who obviously is unhinged, he was deeply confused and conflicted, not only about sexual orientation, but also about which jihadi group he might be aligned with. And so I take the report of his call to 911 during the incident at the Pulse nightclub Sunday morning, where we are told, and we have only been told this, we haven't heard the 911 phone call recording, or even a transcript has not been released to the public. Just like the San Bernardino situation, where we were told that the woman had put out a Facebook pledge of allegiance to the Islamic State during or shortly after the shooting in San Bernardino, we have never seen evidence of that. And so we have to be really highly skeptical. At the same time that we don't become so hardened and cynical that we ignore the real pain, suffering, and human loss that has occurred as a result of this event. My friends at Project Censored, Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff, sent me a link to an interesting background piece about the company that Omar Mateen was working for. It's called G4S, and they are one of the largest employers worldwide. They have 625,000 people on five continents in more than 120 companies. It's a private security company that has customers in government as well as in corporations. It's worked for the U.S., the Brits, Israel, Australia, Chrysler, Amtrak, Apple, Bank of America. Mateen worked there since 2007. And we still don't know exactly. I think he was working at a shopping mall near Orlando, but I haven't seen any direct confirmation of his particular assignment. So this is a huge company with $10 billion in annual revenues. Chevron in Nigeria contracts with G4S for counterinsurgency operations, and they have actual mercenary troops there, not just, you know, rent-a-cops with a walkie-talkie and a baton. So it is interesting. I've linked to this article so you can get the full skinny on G4S if you're interested in that. Sabrina D'Souza is a woman whose case we have followed for over 3 years. She was a CIA officer undercover as a State Department individual assigned to Milan, Italy, when the United States botched the daylight kidnapping of Abu Omar from the streets of Milan in 2003. And if you've followed this case at all, you know that she is now a person without a country. She is trapped in Portugal, where an extradition order may be served on her in the next few days to send her back to Italy, where she was convicted in absentia for her alleged role in the Abu Omar case, along with 22 other Americans. And in an interview with our friend Jason Leopold, that is both an article and a video at Vice News right now, Sabrina D'Souza explains that she partially blames Hillary Clinton for her fate. She says that her representatives, her lawyer, wrote to Clinton when she was still Secretary of State in 2012 and asked her to invoke diplomatic immunity for D'Souza and her colleagues who had been, as we say, convicted in absentia over in Italy. And Hillary Clinton never responded. She also didn't respond, as she is required by law, to the information that D'Souza's lawyers provided that Abu Omar had been tortured when he was renditioned to Egypt. And so D'Souza is awaiting this extradition to be enacted, and the negotiation between Portugal and Italy leaves a gray area. Portuguese authorities believe that she is entitled to an appeal and a review of her sentence before being sent to jail in Italy. The Italian authorities seem to believe that they can put her in prison immediately. And that's what a prosecutor in Milan told Jason Leopold and Vice News. And this would make the first CIA officer to be jailed in a foreign country. And D'Souza said, if I go to jail, I will be the first CIA officer to go to jail. I'll be the first U.S. diplomat to go to jail. And I'll be the one person who then has to shoulder the responsibility of a program, this is rendition, that was designed and authorized by the President of the United States. And so President Obama has some responsibility in this case as well. And the current Secretary of State, John Kerry, could intervene with the Italians and demand diplomatic immunity for D'Souza. Now, I'm trying to line up an interview with her, and I hope it is successful. I'll certainly share that with you as soon as we get it. But one of my questions is, she also seems to be, there's deniability, where the CIA neither confirms nor denies that she worked for them, and the State Department position was a cover job. So Clinton could say, well, you know, she's not really my responsibility. Just like at Benghazi, that's a CIA operation, not a State Department operation. And so that's what leaves Sabrina D'Souza as a woman without a country and abandoned by both of her nominal former employers. And Jason Leopold, the intrepid reporter that he is, also got a hold of Abu Omar earlier this year, and Omar said that he's closely followed the case of D'Souza and believes that she should be pardoned or granted immunity. So here's the guy who was the victim of the botched spy caper that the U.S. engaged in, and he is advocating for relief for Sabrina D'Souza. I find that pretty rich. Also in my Clinton file here, and boy, it piles up in just a couple of days, there is a major lawsuit that is going to be filed soon by Cliff Arnbeck and his co-counsel, Bob Fetrakis. As you know, they were guests on this program just a couple of weeks ago when they visited California before our primary last week, and they raised important questions about, anomalies, inconsistencies that suggest fraud in the Democratic primaries in at least 11 states through this primary cycle. and they're going to file a racketeering lawsuit in the state of Ohio that applies beyond those borders. And Cliff Arnbeck says it's that Ohio racketeering law is the strongest in the country. We can bring in every state. And it is described as coextensive with the federal RICO statute. And he says, so they're nailed. Now, Arnbeck and Fitrakis are still in the investigation stage. They have evidence that leads them to suspect that these elections have been manipulated. But they have not yet named a suspect. And in bold letters, they say, we do not know who has done the shifting of the electronic vote totals. But they have all benefited the campaign of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I have a summary here from KTAR Television that was forwarded by Mark Crispin Miller. And I summarized this and referenced the source. KTAR is a Phoenix television station. And the headline here reads, allegations of voter fraud follow Hillary Clinton campaign across the nation. And they recap the allegations of irregularities starting in Iowa on February 1st, in Nevada on February 20th, Massachusetts on March 1st, and New York on April 19th. And, of course, they have been investigating the shenanigans in their own backyard in the state of Arizona, where John Roberts Brakey, who is the election advocate there, a longtime colleague and a man who I have deep respect for, he sent me a link to the latest Bev Harris report at blackboxvoting.org about how you can rig or reprogram the GEMS, the GEMS tabulators, to use fractional voting. And by assigning a weighted vote, say a Clinton vote gets a fraction of 11 tenths and a Sanders vote gets a fraction of 9 tenths, well, over time, the count will favor the 11 tenths fraction over the 9 tenths, but it really doesn't show up unless you very closely scrutinize the numbers. So there are substantive allegations here of chicanery in the Democratic primary elections. And we take them seriously here, and I will continue to pursue them. Also, the email scandal continues to widen with mainstream outlets digging in. The Wall Street Journal is taking a much closer look at an email trail that shows that as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton presumably used her BlackBerry, and we know she used her home email server to receive and send information about upcoming drone strikes, and these, of course, are secret CIA drone strikes that were being planned for Pakistan. And the rule was that the State Department had a right of approval of these drone killings. And the report from the Wall Street Journal says they only objected to one or two of the attacks. But Clinton aides forward some of these approval emails to her personal account on the private server. So that's what the Wall Street Journal is looking into. And ABC Television has been following the trail that is detailed in some of the emails of a man who was a big donor to Hillary Clinton and to the Clinton Foundation. His name is Rajiv Fernando. He still is, I believe, the head of a high-frequency trading company called Chopper Trading. And we'll put aside issues of the legitimacy of that kind of high-frequency trading. But he ended up being appointed by Hillary Clinton to a fairly sensitive group called the International Security Advisory Board. Now, this is a guy who has no background in the military or in nuclear weapons, but he was put on a panel with experts from those fields, tactical nuclear weapons and arms control issues. And when challenged by ABC News and their reporter Brian Ross, the State Department stalled. Then they waited for Fernando to resign his post. And then they tried to obscure some of the emails that showed that his name had been added to the nominees for this board when Clinton came into office by the office of the Secretary of State. And so it shows that this is a quid pro quo. Here's a guy who donated at least $100,000, if not $250,000, to the Clinton Foundation, and separately was a bundler who raised hundreds of thousands for the Clinton campaigns, going back to 2007 and 2008. And he was rewarded for his financial acumen and access, and that is a really devastating exposure for Secretary Clinton. Now, we'll see how all this plays out. And as you may know, I led my podcast on Friday, which I failed to release until Monday, and that was my blunder. But I led it with the D for Democrat now stands for denial. And the superdelegates in particular are responsible for foisting Hillary Clinton on the Democratic nomination process this year, you know, possibly gaming elections in order to do it. We know that they certainly manhandled Bernie Sanders and his political fortunes along the way. And this is a disaster in progress that we are observing now on a daily basis. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Let's start with Andrew Bodo, who just took out a new annual subscription. Thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate your support. Matthew Daniel kicks in $10 a month. And who else is on my list here? Tim McKay is a monthly subscriber, and so is Grant Gibson. I know he's in Portland, Oregon. So I want to thank those individuals and invite you to participate as well. Come over to peterbcollins.com. And by the way, if you are itching to get a copy of John Perkins' New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I'm down to my last copy. So you should act immediately. Take out a new annual subscription today and send me your mailing address in the continental U.S., and you can be the lucky person who gets the last copy of the John Perkins bonus book from peterbcollins.com. And we are still celebrating, as we did yesterday, the success of our Kickstarter campaign for newsbud.com. The current tally is $151,270, so we passed our goal of $150,000, and we are continuing. We've got another week on this campaign before it expires, and we want to raise more money because some people may not come through on their pledges, and the more money we raise now, the less we have to raise in the future through Kickstarter or other efforts. So if you haven't given yet and you're in a position to do so, I would love it if you come over to newsbud.com and follow the links to Kickstarter and do whatever you can to help fund this new media outlet that is 100% funded by you, the public. I mentioned Jason Leopold in the context of the Sabrina D'Souza case, and Jason, of course, is the guy who uses the Freedom of Information Act more aggressively than perhaps any other reporter in the country. And he is so adept at it that he was invited to testify before the congressional committees last year about the weaknesses in the FOIA law. And so today he writes that the reforming the Freedom of Information Act bill, which is called, it's called the FOIA Improvement Act, and the president has indicated that he is going to sign it. Now, Jason Leopold notes that the bill is somewhat watered down from what the House had introduced. The Senate did the dilution. But his article says that it still contains reforms that will force government agencies to be more transparent and make it easier for journalists, historians, and the public to gain access to their documents. And it codifies an intention that President Obama stated when he entered office to adopt a presumption in favor of disclosure and renew the commitment to the principles embodied in the Freedom of Information Act. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that my interpretation of the whole Hillary Clinton move to set up her own private server was an effort to avoid being accountable under FOIA. And so the bill isn't perfect, but it's an improvement. And the biggest weakness, as Jason testified before Congress last year, is that there are still no penalties for noncompliance with Freedom of Information Act requests. Well, tonight is the meeting between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And it kind of parallels the one that was held in 2008, where Senator Dianne Feinstein invited both to her house and then left and let them talk. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall at the meeting between Bernie and Hillary tonight. I don't know how hard Bernie is going to negotiate to get changes to the platform, to get Hillary to commit to real policy changes, irrespective of the Democratic Party platform. I really don't know how far he is going to push her. And I don't know how receptive she is going to be. And the signals that I read are that Sanders will stand down as a loyal Democrat at some point. But I'd love to see him at least play it out to the convention. And as you know, I'd love to see him bolt the Democratic Party and run as a Green or even possibly as an independent. Because I think the Democratic Party is broken. And the Clintons helped break it and turn it into just an indistinguishable number two corporate party. The Supreme Court, an appeals court for the District of Columbia, has upheld the Federal Communications Commission's actions on net neutrality. It's a 2-1 decision, and AT&T says they will appeal it to the Supreme Court, but it upholds the net neutrality rules that essentially level the playing field between me and Netflix. And what I'm talking about is that depending on where you access my podcast, it may take you 3 minutes to download it. Well, without net neutrality, Netflix would be able to buy its way to faster download speeds for its movies as compared to a little pop-and-pop operator like me. Now to the Supreme Court, which rejected the efforts by Puerto Rico to restructure its own debt in the utility sector. And this is actually not a surprising decision. It was penned by Clarence Thomas, and it was a decision that featured the recusal of Justice Sam Alito. Now, we don't know if he has stock in a company that owns the debt of Puerto Rico or exactly what. He's not required to say why he recused himself, but I always am happy when justices make that decision, and Clarence Thomas could learn a few things from those other justices' recusals. He, of course, has famously failed to recuse himself in the Citizens United case, where he delivered the deciding vote, despite the fact that his wife had worked for the Citizens United group or was somehow deeply involved with them. So what the justices decided is that Puerto Rico must submit to federal bankruptcy law. The Commonwealth tried to write its own bankruptcy bill to deal with the public utility sector, which accounts for about $26 billion of the $72 billion in outstanding debt to Puerto Rico. And this just leaves it up to Congress, which has, in a very mean-spirited way, excluded Puerto Rico from the Chapter 9 bankruptcy law. And so Puerto Rico is on its knees and must continue to bend over for the will of the Republican-controlled Congress, which is doing the bidding of the vulture capitalist bondholders who hold sway over Puerto Rico. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor of Puerto Rican descent was joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a dissent. She said the majority's approach was too mechanical, failed to take into account the purpose of bankruptcy law and the impact of its decision. She wrote, "The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and its municipalities are in the middle of a fiscal crisis. The combined debt of Puerto Rico's three main public utilities exceeds $20 billion. With rising interest rates and limited access to capital markets, their debts are proving unserviceable. And soon, the utilities will be unable to pay for fuel to generate electricity, which will lead to rolling blackouts, and other vital services, including safe drinking water, will be imperiled." And finally today, catching up on a story that I've been looking to have room for a few days. The outgoing Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, made a remarkable move last week. He went public, and he said, yes, the United Nations has removed Saudi Arabia from an investigation into human rights and war crimes violations based on its ongoing war in Yemen. and he said that he had done so because he was threatened with the loss of financing for humanitarian operations in the Palestinian territories, South Sudan, and Syria, if he didn't comply with the demand from the House of Saud. And that, friend, show you really who's running things these days, and that money controls a lot of things that should be decided on other bases. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. Feel free to share this one far and wide. And I'll be here again tomorrow. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.